Hello and welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. We are bringing you the news as it happened 100 years ago, from the eyes, ears, and presses of those who lived through the First World War. Up first this evening, from the end of January 1917, we hear from our newly re-elected leader, President Woodrow Wilson, as told from the pages of The Fatherland.
Mr. Wilson's Sermon on the Mount. President Wilson's Declaration of Peace is the greatest event since the Declaration of War. His address to the Senate is easily the most important speech made by any American president since Washington's farewell address. Will the new policy announced by the president guide us in the future as Washington has guided us in the past? Mr. Wilson's vision of a Monroe Doctrine applied to the entire world is an ideal. That is to say, it is not immediately attainable, but whatever the immediate effect may be, Mr. Wilson has set a new standard for humanity to approach. He has established a new goal. He has ushered in a new epoch. His winged sentences can never be made unspoken. The heart of mankind will never forget them. They will re-echo through time. They will transfigure and transform the fabric of human thought. The world can never be what it was before, since the head of one great nation has uttered in imperishable words the secret dream of all. One thing Mr. Wilson's speech has done, it has informed those British agents who still hope for the participation of the United States on the side of Great Britain that they are making their reckoning without their host. America will lead in peace. She will not follow in war. This conviction, once it is borne home to the British government, will mean 1 year or less of hell on earth. It may mean peace before spring. Mr. Wilson's gospel is as simple as the message of Jesus, but it took sublime courage to proclaim it to a cynical world bereft of reason by strife. We who, for many months, have seen the growth of the new Woodrow Wilson are not surprised by the evolution of the president's mind. The new Woodrow Wilson is the real Woodrow Wilson. In finding himself, he has found the soul of America. He is no longer merely president of the United States. He incarnates, for the time being, the highest aspirations of the American people. He is not only our spokesman, he speaks for liberals and friends of humanity in every nation and for every program of liberty. I would fain believe, he asserts, that I am speaking for the silent mass of mankind everywhere who have as yet had no place or opportunity to speak their real hearts out concerning the death and ruin they see to have come already upon the persons and the homes they hold dear. Lincoln emancipated merely the African Negro. Wilson's speech sets free men and minds in every part of the globe. It is not an attack on property. It is a challenge to every vested interest, to every cobwebbed tradition of secret diplomacy, to every sham of international law. It is the splendid bloom of constructive American statesmanship. Mr. Wilson is not defying our own traditions. In holding out the expectation that the people and the government of the United States will join the other civilized nations of the world in guaranteeing the permanence of peace upon such terms as I have named, I speak with the greater boldness and confidence because it is clear to every man who can think that there is in this promise no break in either our traditions or our policy as a nation, but a fulfillment, rather, of all that we have professed or striven for. I am proposing, as it were, that the nations should with one accord adopt the doctrine of President Monroe as the doctrine of the world, that no nation should seek to extend its policy over any other nation or people, but that every people should be left free to determine its own policy, its own way of development, unhindered, unthreatened, unafraid, the little along with the great and powerful. I am proposing that all nations, henceforth, avoid entangling alliances which would draw them into competition of power, catch them in a net of intrigue and selfish rivalry, and disturb their own affairs with influence intruded from without. There is no entangling alliance in a concert of power. When all unite to act in the same sense with the same purpose, all act in the common interest and are free to live their own lives under a common protection. I am proposing government by the consent of the governed, that freedom of the seas, which in international conference after conference, representatives of the United States have urged with the eloquences of those who are convinced disciples of liberty, and that moderation of armaments, which makes of armies and navies a power for order merely, not an instrument of aggression or of selfish violence. These are American principles, American policies. We can stand for no others. And they are also the principles and policies of forward-looking men and women everywhere, of every modern nation, of every enlightened community. They are the principles of making and must prevail.
A And now we turn to TP's Journal for Men and Women, published in February, for some thoughts on America's newly declared position on the war.
The meaning of America's move. Up to the time at which I am writing this article, which, under the necessities of time, has to go to press many days before the article appears, it has not been definitely decided whether Germany is determined to force America to declare war or not. I think that question is important, but not vital. America has declared her opinions, has taken her side, and whether she has to give us only her moral support or the support of her naval and military resources also is a matter of less importance. The greatest thing is her moral support. It means that we have the entire civilized world on our side. Spain makes only a protest. Holland and Denmark and the Scandinavian countries hold back. We can understand their motives. Whatever else Germany failed to do, she succeeded by her performances in Belgium in convincing the world that her brutality was equal to her arrogance and dishonesty. But they are with us in spirit, and so we may say confidently that on one side is Germany and on the other side is the whole world. I am rejoiced at the adhesion of America to the cause of the Allies for other reasons than their mere moral and material support to a cause they have now made invincible. It has been one of the haunting visions of my life to see a great confederation of the English-speaking democracies of the world. With them, as with us, there is a passionate love of liberty, a passionate faith in democracy. Now that we are last joined in making common war against the savagery of Germany, we must remain together until we have banished from the earth the horrors of German militarism. Joined together with all our gigantic forces combined, with these forces combined in turn with the democracy of France and the liberated Russia of the future, we could command the world. And in commanding the world, we could effectually and promptly stop any such assault on the fundamental liberties of mankind as Germany has attempted in the present war. The nightmare of Europe is rapidly coming to an end, and with the morning light comes the glorious vision of a free, peaceful, and civilized world.
Stay tuned as we take a quick commercial break.
Lux, are you doing everything that can be done for the comfort and well-being of your hero in khaki? Are you washing his flannels, woolens, and hose with Lux? Lux prevents loosely woven textures from matting together and shrinking in the wash. It coaxes rather than forces the dirt from the clothes, leaving garments soft and comfortable as when new. Don't let your hero march in shrunken socks. Be sure and use Lux. It's rub-a-dub-dub, but not at the tub. You mustn't shrink khaki in washing. To call of the drum a million men come, a million shirts Lux should be washing. The name Lever on Soap is a guarantee of purity and excellence. Lever Brothers Limited, Port Sunlight.
Welcome back. We now jump ahead to April 1917, to a time where America's attitudes towards the war have shifted. We bring you two articles from the New York Sun detailing America's shift to war.
President proclaims war. Many Germans arrested. 91 ships seized. All damaged except the Vaterland. U.S. takes wireless plants. Cuba to enter conflict. Steel men save government millions, food mobilized. Wilson signs resolution, signifying entrance of United States into conflict against Germany. Summons flashed to Navy. Fleets guard against attack. U-boats are reported in Gulf of Mexico. President endorses compulsory service. Calls all to support country, defines status of aliens. Following the signing of the joint resolution of Congress, which declares a state of war existing between Germany and the United States, President Wilson issued a formal proclamation. The signing of the resolution of Congress put the United States on a war basis automatically. The proclamation of the President sets forth the regulations which, through the authority vested in him by Congress, he deems necessary for the public safety. Authorization for seizure of all wireless stations in the United States and its possessions was issued by the President last night. Enforcement of the order has been entrusted to Secretary Daniels. All radio stations that cannot be used by the Navy will be closed. Preparations to conserve the food supply of the nation and to increase crop acreage have been started at Washington. Secretary Houston of the Department of Agriculture will leave today on a trip to confer with the Commissioners of Agriculture in the Middle West. Any attempt to curtail the supply will be punished forthwith. An appeal for subscriptions from $100 million to $200 million for farm loan banks will be issued at once. War revenue plans of the government include a $1.8 billion bond issue and increased income, inheritance, and liquor taxes. Majority Leader Kitchen is expected to oppose the administration's plans and will try to lay all the burdens on the wealthy. President Menocal has sent a message to the Cuban Congress urging it to declare that a state of war exists with Germany. Each house has appointed a committee to confer on the message. It is expected that Cuba will enter the war and that the Republic will pledge its full cooperation with the United States in resources and men, as recommended in President Menocal's message. Practically all the great steel producers of the country have agreed to sell Navy material to the government on the 1916 price basis, thus saving $18 million for the administration. Bernard M. Baruch is negotiating with producers of aluminum, brass, nickel, and some of the rarer metals to bring about a reduction in price to the United States of such materials. A call for mobilization of the Navy has been flashed to every warship and naval station of the United States. All naval militia and naval reserves and auxiliary merchant craft, including private yachts and motorboats offered to the government, thereby are ordered into service. The War Department is seeking 400,000 men to bring the regular Army and National Guard to war strength. 4 months will be required to register the citizens available under the draft to furnish 500,000 more. New York will furnish 1/10 of the total. Heads of four of the greatest packing plants in the world, with headquarters in Chicago, have declared that no matter what the demands of our government may be for meats for the forces of the United States, those demands will be met. It is further stated that the packing plants will be ready to ship United States orders for meat immediately upon request. America's entrance into the war has added strength to the demands for a more democratic government in Germany. A German socialist group now asserts that the question looms as the most vital and burning of the hour.
President's Proclamation for State of War. Whereas the Congress of the United States, in the exercise of the constitutional authority vested in them, have resolved by joint resolution of the Senate and the House of Representatives, bearing date this day, that the state of war between the United States and the Imperial German government, which has been thrust upon the United States, is hereby formally declared. Whereas by sections 4068, 4069, and 4070 of the revised statutes, further provision is made relative to alien enemies. Now, therefore, I, Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States of America, do hereby proclaim to all whom it may concern that a state of war exists between the United States and the Imperial German government, and I do specifically direct all officers, civil or military, of the United States that they exercise vigilance and zeal in the discharge of duties incident to such a state of war. And I do moreover earnestly appeal to all American citizens that they, in loyal devotion to their country, dedicated from its foundation to the principles of liberty and justice, uphold the laws of the land and give undivided and willing support to those measures which may be adopted by the constitutional authorities in prosecuting the war to a successful issue and in obtaining a secure and just peace. And, acting under and by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution of the United States and the said sections of the revised statutes, I do hereby further proclaim and direct that the conduct to be observed on part of the United States towards all natives, citizens, denizens, or subjects of Germany, being males of the age of 14 years or upward, who shall be within the United States and not actually naturalized, who for the purposes of this proclamation and under such sections of the revised statutes are termed alien enemies, shall be as follows. All alien enemies are enjoined to preserve the peace towards the United States and to refrain from the crime against the public safety and from violating the laws of the United States and of the states and territories thereof, and to refrain from actual hostility or giving information, aid, or comfort to the enemies of the United States, and to comply strictly with the regulations which are hereby, or which may be from time to time, promulgated by the President, and so long as they shall conduct themselves in accordance with the law, all citizens of the United States are enjoined to preserve the peace and to treat them with all such friendliness as may be compatible with loyalty and allegiance to the United States. And all alien enemies who fail to conduct themselves are so enjoined, in addition to all other penalties prescribed by law, shall be liable to restraint, or to give security, or to remove and depart from the United States in the manner prescribed by sections 4069 and 4070 of the revised statutes, and as prescribed in the regulations duly promulgated by the President. And pursuant to the authority vested in me, I hereby declare and establish the following regulations, which I find necessary in the premises and for the public safety. 1. An alien enemy shall not have in his possession, at any time or place, any firearm, weapon, or implement of war, or component part thereof, ammunition, maxim, or other silencer, bomb or explosive, or material used in the manufacture of explosives. 2. An alien enemy shall not have in his possession, at any time or place, or use or operate any aircraft or wireless apparatus, or any form of signaling device, or any form of cipher code, or any paper, document, or book written or printed in cipher, or in which they may be invisible writing. 3. All property found in the possession of an alien enemy in violation of the foregoing regulations shall be subject to seizure by the United States. 4. An alien enemy shall not approach or be found within 1/2 mile of any federal or state fort, camp, arsenal, aircraft station, government or naval vessel, navy yard, factory, or workshop for the manufacture of munitions of war or any products for the use by the Army or Navy. 5. An alien enemy shall not write, print, or publish any attack or threat against the government or Congress of the United States, or either branch thereof, or against the measures or policy of the United States, or against the person or property of any person in the military, naval or civil service of the United States, of the states or territories, or of the District of Columbia, or of any municipal governments therein. 6. An alien enemy shall not commit or abet any hostile act against the United States, or give information, aid, or comfort to its enemies. 7. An alien enemy shall not reside in, or continue to reside in, to remain in, or to enter any locality which the President may from time to time designate by executive order as a prohibitive area in which residence by an alien enemy shall be found by him to constitute a danger to the public peace and safety of the United States, except by permit from the President, and except under such limitations and restrictions as the President may prescribe. 8. An alien enemy whom the President shall have reasonable cause to believe to be aiding or about to aid the enemy, or to be at large to the danger of the public peace or safety of the United States, or to have violated or to be about to violate any of those regulations, shall remove to any location designated by the President by executive order, and shall not remove therefrom without a permit, or shall depart from the United States if so required by the President. 9. No alien enemy shall depart from the United States until he shall have received a permit as the President shall prescribe, or except under order of a court, judge, or justice under sections 4069 or 4070 of the revised statutes. 10. No alien enemy shall land in or enter the United States except under such restrictions and at such places as the President may prescribe. 11. If necessary to prevent violations of these regulations, all alien enemies will be obligated to register. 12. An alien enemy whom there may be reasonable cause to believe to be aiding or about to aid the enemy, or who may be at large to the danger of the public peace or safety, or who violates or attempts to violate, or of whom there is a reasonable ground to believe that he is about to violate any regulation, duty promulgated by the President, or any criminal law of the United States, or of the states or territories thereof, will be subject to summary arrest by the United States Marshal, or his deputy, or such other officer as the President shall designate, and to confinement in such penitentiary, prison, jail, military camp, or other place of detention as may be directed by the President. This proclamation and the regulation herein contained shall extend and apply to all land and water, continental or insular, in any other way within jurisdiction of the United States. It witness whereof I have hereunto set my hand and caused the seal of the United States to be fixed. Woodrow Wilson.
We now move to a view of how the previous news is affecting local life. From the pages of the Ardmore Chronicle, a local appeal.
Ardmore dentist makes an appeal. Dr. J.W. Goddard, one of three selected to organize dental unit. Representative dentists of Montgomery County met at Norristown last Thursday to discuss the formation of a dental unit for hospital service in case of war. The professional men, expressing themselves enthusiastically, went to Norristown from Ardmore, Collegeville, Pottstown, Flowertown, and Conshohocken. Dr. F.W. Sadler of Norristown presided. Patriotic spirit abounded, and desire to show loyalty and work for the USA was paramount. A committee of three, composed of Dr. Sadler, Dr. J.W. Goddard, Ardmore, and Dr. S.D. Cornish, Collegeville, was selected to attend to organization. The committee called a meeting for April 11th at 8 p.m. in the YMCA Norristown for the purpose of electing officers, adopting a constitution and bylaws, and such other business as they shall decide. Every dentist in the county is asked to attend. During the discussion, Dr. Goddard declared, "The professional man, such as we are, would be a hindrance to an army if he was encumbered with heavy accoutrements. The physical hardships would be too arduous for old men and men who live sedentary lives. In fact, the army would have to send a nurse with each dentist to nurse him into shape for the march if he was a private in the ranks. If enlisted in the hospital corps, he could do his bit for his country in an efficient manner and give service according to his ability. Now is the time to show if one is a slacker or a worker. Shall one join this service or wait until the time when one will be asked which place one will be compelled to join? That's the question." Dr. S.D. Cornish of Collegeville said that the part which was assigned to him he would cheerfully endeavor to perform. He felt that any man not willing to help his country to the extent of his ability should be shown the vital necessity of his error. He also said that under the instructions of the parent body, no man could or would be given any work which he could not perform, and that a hospital base in Montgomery County, situated in Norristown, would be a great convenience to the naval base situated at the seaboard, because it would be close to all zones in the Middle Atlantic states. Dr. Sadler's motion to invite the Women's Preparedness League, the Lawyers League, the Physicians Unit, and Company F to view the war pictures and to listen to the dentists who have returned from the war zone lecture was accepted with cheers. All dentists are asked to enlist now.
Up next, we have an opinion piece on the role of newspapers in a newly embattled America. This is a plea to the press, printed April 18th, 1917, in the pages of Viereck's American Weekly.
A plea to the press. Gentlemen of the press, there has been a difference of opinion among newspaper men regarding the ethics of the World War. The majority of papers have, however, since the beginning, espoused the cause of the Allies as against that of the Central Powers, while a small minority took the opposite view. This was before the entry of our country in the capacity of a belligerent. From now on, it is the expressed, plain duty of all loyal citizens to consider the interests of America solely. Up to this point, our fellow editors will unanimously agree with us. Now, however, the time has come for publishers, as well as citizens, to prove the depth of their sincerity as patriots. Viereck's Weekly is one of the small minority group which vigorously opposed the entry of America into the international conflict. When an adverse decision was rendered because of the High Tribunal of National Demand, we completely withdrew our opposition because we consider it to be the obligation and duty of a paper to avoid adding to the difficulties of our government at a time when that government needs the undivided support of all of its sons. Some of you, for reasons of prejudice, some from conviction, have taken throughout the progress of the war an anti-German standpoint. We are at last finally at war with Germany, and we shall obtain by force of arms redress for the indignities we have suffered at her hands. This should be sufficient to satisfy the bitterest enemies among us of the German government. We think that now all newspapers should unite in aiding our country to cope with the situation ahead. And this aid is badly rendered when a newspaper wastes its valuable space in seeking to keep open old wounds or in trying to sow prejudice, dissension, and distrust at home here against our German-American citizens and neighbors. The newspaper which pursues this policy is doing our country and the fair name of American justice an irreparable injury. We honestly believe that the majority of our fellow publishers who have been and are still guilty of this conduct are actuated by the most patriotic of motives. But if today an individual or newspaper editor professes to believe in the principles of true Americanism and undivided patriotism, then we think that these words, proclaimed only a few days ago by our president, should go to his heart and guide, in the future, his tongue and pen with more fairness. We are, let me say, the sincere friends of the German people. We shall happily still have an opportunity to prove that friendship in our daily attitude and actions towards the millions of men and women of German birth who live among us. They are, most of them, as true and loyal Americans as if they had never known any other allegiance. When President Wilson sets such an example, we think that none need be ashamed to follow it.
To finish up this week of Mail Call, we turn to the pages of our very own publication, The Villanovan. An editorial from the June 1917 edition, The Supreme Test.
The Supreme Test. In times of great crisis, there is a tendency for us to leave solutions entirely to officials. We think the easiest way is to place all the responsibility on others. We are inclined to lose sight of the fact that each individual of this great nation has serious obligations. Never before has a nation been called upon to face such difficulties as our beloved land is experiencing today. No land has ever dared attempt to shoulder such world burdens. As dangerous as it is unique, her position claims our hearty allegiance and support. Our president has reminded us in a few words of the key to the solution of the hardest problems. The supreme test of the nation has come. We must speak, act, and serve together. We must speak together in one accord with the voice of our country and the voice of our president. To criticize the workings of our government, to look for flaws in the policies of our leaders, especially in these trying times, should be far from the heart of the true patriot. That our country will use great and powerful methods for solving the world's problems, we doubt not. It is equally certain that we as individuals cannot understand them in all their circumstances and intricacies. Therefore, if we cannot give an intelligent explanation of them, let us preserve a respectful silence. It is for us to put confidence in our leaders and spread goodwill toward them. Loyal speech is one way of starting enthusiasm and actual effort in economy and thrift. Let us not fail to speak the good, loyal, necessary word. We must act together. The policy of our country should be our policy. Our love is proven by our actions. To stand calmly by and see our nation's cause in peril, to smile with self-satisfied complacency and proclaim her policy dangerous and wrong, is disloyalty and treachery. We must serve together. This is the great pledge of our devotion. In service, all virtues may be included. To conclude that military life is the only form of service to our nation would be a great mistake. That, indeed, is a glorious sacrifice, and we love and laud our boys in blue who have gone forth so bravely and unselfishly to fight for Old Glory's honor. But there is another service we must not forget. Many of us will not be called to military service, but not one of us can escape the army. Each one of us is enrolled in the great army of service. Each must do his bit. Opportunities are not lacking. The present is no time for wasteful idleness. We should endeavor to be producers or to assist and the increase of production. Farming will be of the greatest value in these days. To instance one field in which most of our students could aid, consider the tilling of the soil, the farming of our land. Think of the amount of products that must be sent abroad to feed our troops and keep starving Europe alive. Think of the numbers of our own who will be left without means of support because their providers have gone to the front. Employment on farms can be secured with ease. It is a necessary and patriotic work and should therefore appeal to all who are able to devote their time to it. Remember that the machinists, the farmers, the miners, the patient mothers and wives bearing the burden at home belong in the truest sense to the great army of service. Their work is as heroic and as effective for peace and freedom as that of the throngs on bloody battlefields. Our attitude toward our country must be that of a child to its parent. The family is the foundation and type of the state. Were our family in peculiar difficulties, how willing and courageous should we be in sacrificing every personal comfort? Thus should we act today. We, personally, should avoid waste and be economical and provident. In his personal appeal to the people, our president said, "This is the time for America to correct her unpardonable fault of wastefulness and extravagance." May we not be backward in cooperating with our leader. Whether our service be on the field of battle, or in the less demonstrative, though none the less glorious, work of the home, the farm, the shop, or the mine, let us speak, act, and serve in one accord. May our efforts be commensurate with that supreme test, the test of love.
That's all for Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. Historical documents for this episode were accessed through the digital collections of the Digital Library of Villanova University and the Library of Congress. Our theme music is from Till We Meet Again, as performed by Nicholas Orlando's Orchestra. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War centennial exposition. For more information, visit our website at wwionline.org. This episode features the voice talents of Laura Bang, Damian Katz, Sarah Marcinick, Amanda McCollum, Courtney Schultz, Nicole Subic, and David Uspel. I'm your narrator, Chris Hallberg. This episode was produced and edited by Amanda McCollum, and our executive producer is Laura Bang. Thank you for listening to our podcast. And again, for more information, please visit our website at wwionline.org.